Shall I go there?
Please.
Thanks to all of you for coming back after lunch. And Erica, thanks to you for allowing me to horn in on the British Animal Studies Network, which has been so far devoted largely to dogs. This is going to be a departure from that. No complaints there. Love dogs. But I find myself working more and more at the intersections of environmental studies, food studies, and animal studies. So my, I find that there are certain species that have more impact on our food systems than others, which means I've been turning to rats and locusts and beetles, and now today, vultures. So let me just get started. This day I shot a condor. So writes Charles Darwin in The Voyage of the Beagle, which includes a description of his travels through Santa Cruz, Patagonia, and the Falkland Islands. After, Darwin details the condor's habitats, mating habits, and puzzling feeding practices. And this is the first quotation. When an animal is killed in the country, he writes, it's well known that the condors, like other carrion vultures, soon gain intelligence of it and congregate in an inexplicable manner, picking the skeleton clean before the flesh is in the least degree tainted. End quote. He pauses in his naturalistic account to consider scientifically the condor's sense of smell. Remembering the experiments of Mr. Audubon on the little smelling powers of carrion hawks, that's Darwin devises his own experiment to determine the quality of the condor's olfaction. Having folded a piece of meat in a white paper, he carries it before a row of condors tethered in the street. Evoking no response, he throws the wrapped package about a yard in front of an old male bird, he says, who ignores it. Finally, Darwin uses a stick to push the wrapped meat closer and closer to the beak of the condor. Only when the bill and packet touch, he reports, was, quote, the paper instantly torn off with fury, and at the same moment, every bird in the long row began struggling and flapping its wings, end quote. Now, Darwin jumps to no conclusions. The evidence, quote, in favor and against the acute smelling powers of carrion vultures, he concludes, is singularly balanced. And Darwin's preoccupation with the olfactory power of condors places him in a long line of natural philosophers and scientists deeply invested in whether or not big carrion-eating birds locate their meals through a heightened sense of smell. And here are some of the highlights from that history. In the 13th century, Frederick II had sewn shut the eyes of vultures, presented them with rotting food, and found them incapable of locating it. Smell, nevertheless, continued to be regarded as the defining characteristic of carrion birds, for early modern philosophers, a given. The 17th century naturalist Mark Catesby reports of vultures, quote, these birds have a most acute sense and smell carrion at a vast distance, to which they resort from all quarters, wheeling about and making a gradual descent till they reach the ground, end quote. In the 18th century, Buffon replicates and reinforces this assumption, which during the 19th century was subjected to several experiments, a whole flurry of experiments, including those by John James Audubon, who, like Darwin, suspected that the smelling power of vultures was grossly exaggerated. Significantly, Audubon's opinion was deeply unpopular. When he reported his findings to a zoological group in London, tempers flared, there were rumors of fisticuffs having broken out over this, among the zoologists, and the zoologists immediately divided themselves into two parties, the Nosarians and the anti-Nosarians, who then conducted their own experiments. Darwin mentions two, the first by the British biologist Richard Owen, who, having dissected what he thought was the head of a turkey and also a turkey vulture, claimed to have located in the latter neurological evidence of a more highly developed olfactory system. And the other experiment by the Reverend John Bachman, Botman came to the opposite conclusion. And you can read more about those experiments in quotation too. Now, what do we now know? We now know that some of this dissension arose from a failure to collectively distinguish among different kinds of carrion birds. Condors, king vultures, and the American black vulture do not have a powerful sense of smell, but turkey vultures or cathartes do. And there are a lot of missteps here. Audubon seems to have confused the black vulture with the turkey vulture in his dissections, which in some ways is understandable because vulture is not really a species. As Benjamin Wilkinson argues, it's not even a technical term, but at various points and in different historical contexts, it's been used to describe birds as different as eagles, kites, and hawks, and sometimes even flamingos. While species differences among carrion birds is a fascinating subject in its own right, and one already covered in part by Tom Van Doren and Wilkinson, what interests me about these debates and Darwin's participation in them is a more general problem. How Western taboos against eating found meat are deeply entangled with the discourse of smell, assumptions about animality, and the anthropological writing which gave those assumptions a scientific cast. Taxonomic slippages, I think, are not just bad science that could be corrected, but symptoms of an anxiety, a collective anxiety that's probably mostly Western European and Christian, about eating found meat. So now I want to talk a little bit about eagles and vultures and the appetite for rotting things. In his Natural History of Birds, published in 1771, Buffon sketches out parallels between certain birds and their quadruped counterparts based on their dispositions, habits, and original appetites. Falcons, hawks, and birds trained for sport, he compares to dogs and foxes. The, quote, noble and generous eagle, he considers analogous to the lion. The, quote, vulture, cruel and insatiable, to the tiger. The kite, the buzzard, the crow, which only prowl among carrion and garbage, to the hyenas, the wolves, and jackals, end quote. He later expands on this schema, explaining that the vulture unites the strength and cruelty of the tiger, quote, with the cowardice and voracity of the jackals, which gather in troops to devour carrion and dig up carcasses. And this is quotation three. Unlike eagles, which he wrongly assumes never scavenge, and this is an important point, that so-called vultures do occasionally eat live prey, and eagles do, in fact, scavenge. Vultures are incited by what he calls a low gormandizing instinct, and they seldom attack living animals when they can satiate their voracity on the carcasses of the dead ones. Also, rather than attacking alone, they, quote, combine in flocks like base assassins and are rather robbers than warriors, birds of carnage than birds of prey, end quote, collecting in numbers to pour upon the forlorn individual. Vultures tear, quote, the mangled carcass to the bones, and what he imagines is the bitterness of unprovoked rage. Now, clearly, Buffon's energetic descriptions are animated by a preference for hunting over scavenging, the former, in his view, facilitated by courage and keen sight, the latter by cowardice and smell. Less clearly, perhaps, they are driven by racialized conversations about the superiority of sight to smell. Among 18th century philosophers, and Erica referred to this in her opening remarks, a strong sense of smell was associated with an animal existence that significantly so-called civilized humans had presumably risen above. Physiologists Thomas Willis and Albert Van Heller had both argued that the nerves for smelling were larger in animals than in man, since man learns primarily through taste and sight. Indeed, sight might be associated with culture and smell with nature. As Van Heller puts it, this is a quotation, the sense of smell was less important to man, for he was destined to walk upright. He was discover from a distance, and this idea of proximity is important. what might be his food, social life, and language were designed to enlighten him about the properties of the things that appeared to him to be edible." End quote. Judging from such comments, about the only purpose smell still served for 18th century humans was as a kind of instrument of vigilance, what Alain Corbin calls in The Foul and the Fragrant, an animal sense associated with self-preservation rather than higher activities. And this is Corbin, repelled by what is in a state of decomposition, he claims, the human nose warns against poisons. Now, let me just say that I'm skeptical of this idea. Unlike sight, smell acts in what Oliver Goldsmith terms a narrow sphere and disgusts, he writes, almost as frequently as it gives pleasure. In this context, precisely because the clear-sighted eagle, quote, discovers from a distance what is meant to be his food, he becomes more human than birds like the vulture, thought to operate largely, if not exclusively, through a sense of smell. Even worse for vultures, because vultures are enticed rather than revolted by the rot to which they are alerted, they embody the obverse or even perverse of human smell. As Buffon puts it, quote, corruption and infection, instead of driving vultures them to a distance, are to them powerful attractions. So vultures are doubly condemned, first for the objects of their appetite, carrion, and second for their ability to find it. Their seemingly inhuman lack of disgust at the odor of decay distinguishes them from the so-called nobler eagle and from humans alike. There's a lot to be said about disgust, but I won't say it now. Maybe we can talk about that. Tom Van Doren and others have written eloquently and at length about the Western European attitude toward vultures and other carrion eaters, detailing their crucial ecological functions, especially in Africa and India, where vultures tend to be, well, there's an ambivalence, but they are often celebrated rather than reviled. And I should add that vultures, they're on the verge of extinction, partly because the cattle they eat have been, many of the especially the poor population in India will give cattle a drug called diclofenac. What is it, Andrew? Is an anti? Yes, that, which turns out to be poisonous to vultures. So 97% of the three main species have now disappeared. The scientific name for the turkey vulture, Cathartes, means purifier in Greek. Carrion eaters help cleanse the land of rotting human and animal bodies that can serve as sources of disease. Significantly, and somewhat surprisingly, the ecological value of carrion eaters was recognized in 18th century Europe. Buffon cites Chevalier de Marchais about how turkey vultures were protected in Spain because they helped to contain infection generated by the widespread taking of hides. They would just take the hides and leave the bodies there. But such protective practices horrify Buffon, who accuses the Spanish of having, quote, multiplied this disgusting kind of turkey, which can now, he says, be found in Guyana, Brazil, and New Spain or Chile. So why did Buffon and some of his European contemporaries expend so much energy on condemning the vultures, these, quote, voracious, slothful, offensive, and hateful animals, according to Buffon, as noxious during their lifetime, as useless after their death? At some level, I suspect, vultures represented for Buffon unmediated feeding practices that were not actually peculiar to vultures, but were shared by other humans, practices that threatened Western European agricultural norms. This year, a new book came out about scavenging, and it's widely recognized that it's an under-examined behavior across species. In the same way that Europeans and later Americans sought identification with the eagle, falcon, and hawk, they linked cultures at the edge of empire, morally and behaviorally, with the carrion-eating vultures, with what Buffon calls robbers rather than warriors, birds of carnage rather than birds of prey. The important point here is that always such descriptions stink. William Bosman reports on Negroes, what he calls Negroes, on the coast of Guinea, who commonly eat a shark called hayes or requiens. Although he says Europeans never eat them, the indigenous population lays them out in great shoals on the beach where they lay rotting and stinking 7 or 8 days, after which they are greedily eaten as a delicacy. End quote. In China, writes Adam Smith, poor people descend to the level of carrion eaters, eager, he writes, to fish up the nastiest garbage thrown overboard from any European ship. Any carrion, the carcass of a dead cat or dog, for example, though half putrid and stinking, is as welcome to them as the most wholesome food to the people of other countries. End quote. Now, such historical examples are significant to contemporary animal studies in part, I would argue, because they underscore how a discourse of animality anchored by the sense of smell helped to define both Europeans and their cultural others, mostly the Indians and Africans subjected to and by colonial schematics. As we have seen, the heightened sense of smell attributed to some animals and exemplified by the vulture was perceived as being unnecessary, even inimical to civilized human life. What kind of surprises me, well, according to Corbin, early anthropologists agreed that the sense of smell is more highly developed among, quote, savages than among civilized men, and Oliver Goldsmith, to name one, asserts that while the sense of smell is inferior in men, quote, it is much stronger in those nations that abstain from luxurious ways of living and from animal food than among us of Europe. Goldsmith mentions how the Brahmins of India and their ability to smell water, quote, have a power of smelling equal to what it is in most other creatures. The Negroes of the Antilles, Goldsmith continues, by the smell alone can distinguish between the footsteps of a Frenchman and of a Negro, end quote. Scavenging and smell, humans in the more than human world are deeply entangled then in an interdisciplinary history now rendered nearly invisible by disciplinary boundaries. Although most humans and animals are opportunistic scavengers, and although no chemical difference exists between freshly found and recently hunted meat, and that's a whole other area of research, scavenging cultures are denied what postcolonial critics call coevalness, and are regarded instead as part of an earlier stage of development, one dominated by the nose. Surprisingly, in The Foul and the Fragrant, Corbin replicates the view that non-Europeans are more driven by olfaction than are their European counterparts. He writes, even if some anecdotes on this subject seem exaggerated, observations of adolescent savages have confirmed that people who have been raised outside civilized society have a superior sense of smell, end quote. Now, so far as I understand it, his assumption is just flat wrong. A recent study at the University of Pennsylvania, which is where the smell test that's used in all experiments was designed, determines that, and we've been talking about this, individual training rather than ethnic being or anything else is the most important factor in smell sensitivity. Moreover, as I mentioned, and ironically, turkey vultures, according to recent experiments, are blessed not only with an excellent sense of smell, but also with the proverbial eyes of an eagle, that they did not have to lose one to compensate. 18th century stadial theory, then, offers little by way of truth about the way others smell. Indeed, its depiction of the senses amounts mostly to a series of cultural projections. Yet tracing these projections allows us to reconsider not only crucial continuities between speciesism and racism that might otherwise be naturalized in contemporary science and anthropology, but also anxieties about our arbitrary distinctions between the fresh and the rotten. As W.K. Kellogg, and yes, this is the Kellogg of the cornflake empire, reminds us, a dead cow or sheep lying in a pasture is recognized as carrion. The same sort of carcass dressed and hung in a butcher's stall passes for food. End quote. Scavengers, then, have much in common with post-industrial meat-eating humans. My question is how our attempts at moral and theoretical purification have shored up false differences, including the historical desire to privilege the visual over smell and other forms of knowing. Thank you.